And now for something completely different.
Forget everything you've been told by others before. Get ready for the real deal. The full story. The whole enchilada. It's the Lance Roberts Show. Presented by Clarity Financial. It's life, money, and sweat equity. Now, welcome in to the Lance Roberts Show.
And welcome to today's edition of the Lance Roberts Show podcast right here at realinvestmentadvice.com. Well, another day. I tell you, this has been one of those weeks where the market can just not get it together. It's almost like one of those old health alert commercials where it's like, help, I've fallen and I can't get up. That's exactly what's going on in this market, is despite the fact that for the last 4 days we have tried to rally, the markets have not been able to hold on to any gains. In fact, on Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday of this week, big upside opens, wound up giving it back all by the end of the day, managed to eke out a small gain. And take a look at this. For the week, I mean, despite all this choppiness that we currently have going on in the markets right now, you take a look at the market for the week, and we have barely moved. We are literally up about 4 points for the week so far. And again, markets are still trying to bottom along the support line that we've been holding at 2633, but the markets have been unable to really generate any momentum. Now, that's concerning here, because as we move into next week, this is the best opportunity we have all year right now of having a Santa Claus rally, and we've been unable to really muster any strength in the market. And this is despite good news on trade. Of course, every time we get news on, you know, good news on the markets from trade, we get bad news from somewhere else. Economic data coming in weaker, trade deficit bigger than expected, producer prices declining, export prices, import prices also on the decline. We're seeing real signs of economic weakness here. Estimates for 2019 are being ratcheted down because of what's going on with trade wars and, of course, the economic data as well. This is all pressuring stocks here currently. The risk here is that if the markets can't muster up a rally next week, the downside risk in the market is continuing to build here. So pay attention to what's going on with your portfolio. Make sure you follow our rules that we posted in our newsletter last week. But more importantly, just pay attention to the risk you're taking. Again, right now, cash continues to be the best opportunity as a hedge for portfolios. We'll come back in just a moment. We're gonna talk with Pedro da Costa. He's the reporter for Market News International, Forbes, MarketWatch. We're gonna talk about the Fed, that is his specialty. And we're talking about Jerome Powell. Coming up next week, Jerome Powell is gonna raise interest rates potentially and tell us what he thinks about future rate hikes. We're gonna analyze it all with Pedro da Costa right after the break.
Get daily investment news you can use, delivered at the speed of the internet. Sign up for Lance's newsletter now at LanceRobertsShow.com.
For the best proprietary stock and ETF analysis by Lance Roberts, subscribe now to the new professional version of Real Investment Advice,
RIA Pro.
You'll get the expanded newsletter and critical investment information you need with the professional version of Real Investment Advice,
RIA Pro.
Subscribe now at realinvestmentadvice.com and click on the RIA Pro tab. The Pro site is now operational. Subscribe now at realinvestmentadvice.com and click on the RIA Pro tab.
RIA Pro.
Lance Roberts returns.
Merry Christmas to you too, you little freak.
I know you know that I know that you know that I know.
That's one of my daily opportunities that I have to spend some quality time with myself.
Starting Monday, January 7th at 6 a.m. on AM 700, The Voice of Texas.
Welcome to the Lance Roberts Show podcast here at realinvestmentadvice.com. Today, our special guest, Pedro da Costa, who writes for Market News International. Also, you can find him at Forbes and MarketWatch, and I encourage you to follow all of his writings. In fact, every week, I generally have an article from Pedro in our reading list at realinvestmentadvice.com. But again, great source of inside information, particularly his specialty, the Federal Reserve. And of course, this has been the hot topic, particularly over the course of the last couple of months, ever since, and Pedro, this is to you. You know, back in October, Jerome Powell, Fed chairman, said, hey, you know what? We're going to continue hiking rates. We're way far away from the neutral rate of the economy. And all of a sudden, a month later, a 10% decline in the market. And of course, now a different change in tone from the Federal Reserve saying, hey, you know what? We're closer to that neutral rate than not. What was your takeaway from that kind of announcement last week, and particularly as we head into the Fed meeting on the 18th and 19th of this month? Do you think the markets may have misinterpreted what he said, or do you think he was specifically saying what he meant to say?
I actually think, having watched several transitions, from Fed chair transitions, starting from Alan Greenspan to Bernanke, then Bernanke and Janet Yellen, and now Yellen to Powell, I can safely say that what we witnessed was a very rookie mistake from Jerome Powell that he then had to course correct. And what I mean by that is that he's sort of so excited about the economic data he's seeing that he spoke in terms that were more ebullient and more optimistic than his own forecasts suggested, which threw the market in for a loop because it kind of, and the other thing that he said, of course, that we were, far away from the neutral rate, potentially not even close. I forget what the exact language was, right. But he suggested that, there were a significant quantity of rate hikes to come, which was not the market's immediate expectations. And so that kind of led to it kick-started a sell-off that we really haven't seen the end of just yet. Of course, there were other factors involved like trade tensions and so on. But right. I really think it was Jerome Powell making a rookie mistake. They then send out Richard Clarida to the vice chair on CNBC to give an interview saying exactly the opposite, that we are, in fact, close to the neutral rate, which, of course, maybe corrected the message, but also confused the hell out of everyone. And then Jerome Powell had to come in himself and say, OK, we are close to the neutral rate. And you look at the language and it changed over like a month and a half period right. dramatically. So it was a rookie mistake and a pretty bad one.
Right. Well, and I guess the big question, though, is that he's got an opportunity here to really clarify his message on the 18th and 19th. Of course, the expectation is right now that, they'll hike rates by 25 basis points at this meeting. He'll have the opportunity at the post-meeting press conference about really clarifying these statements about what he feels going into next year. Expectations for Fed hikes this year in 2019 have fallen sharply between 0 and 1. What's your kind of takeaway from that kind of overall tenor and change? Does this put the Fed in a much tougher position here, or does this something that you think Chairman Powell will clarify a lot more on the 18th and 19th?
Well, I don't know if it puts them in a tougher position in the sense that if they don't really want to hike, it actually helps them to have moderated market expectations for a lot more hikes. Mm-hmm. But it doesn't help them in a sense that you want the whole point of Fed messaging. It's supposed to be continuous and transparent. And of course, maybe market conditions and economic data have changed a little bit over the last month and a half, but not potentially dramatically enough to warrant that kind of, drastic shift in policy messaging. So I think that's the sort of mistake that Fed officials fall into. I think this is the problem. The Fed officials have a dual role. One is they find that they have to be forecasters of the economy, but at the same time, they feel like they have to cheerlead the economy because market sentiment is based in part on what they say.
Right.
But if they go too far on the cheerleading end, then they get over their skis, which is exactly what Powell did. And then they have to rein everything in. And so that leads to just volatility, and that's bad for the economy and for their mandate, really.
I think that's a really interesting point that you brought up about the cheerleading part of the messaging that they do. And part of me has always wondered if we would be better off with just having the Fed do their job in the background very quietly. Because of this reason is that, can you imagine a Fed press conference, say it was Janet Yellen, back in 2015, 2016, during that correction, or even Jerome Powell this year, and part of this correction, he comes out and he says, well, everything kind of really didn't go the way we thought it was going to, and the economy seems to be a lot weaker than we thought. So we're going to stop rate hikes. Well, immediately, we're going to be not only down 400, 500, 600, 700, 800 points on the markets, but you're going to have, to your point, a very drastic change to consumer sentiment and investor sentiment in particular, which would potentially foster the onset of an economic slowdown. So they're in a really tough position. They can't really come out and tell you the exact truth of what's going on. They've got to almost sugarcoat everything to keep markets complacent to some degree because of the negative economic impact that would occur from, negative comments they might make. So would it be better off if they just kind of work quietly in the background and didn't have all these press conferences every month?
So here's my take, is absolutely not, because I'm a reporter and I want as much transparency. I want to get to ask Jerome Powell questions. on a weekly basis if I can.
Right.
You know, not just monthly. In fact, it was my, I'd like to think there was some of my reporting on the Fed's lack of transparency, realized at Reuters back in during the crisis, that led the Fed to decide to have press conferences. And part [S2] Right. [S1] Of the idea was actually to fix some of the cacophony that you alluded to. So some of the problems you have, there are many problems with Fed communications. And in fact, I'm working on a book about this. That's kind of my big background project that I'm working on about how the Fed can better sell itself to the public. I think the Fed is a fairly upstanding and you know, public-minded institution, but it creates the appearance of closeness to the banks that is damaging to its reputation. And so basically what I think the Fed needs to do is just to be more coherent with its messaging rather than speak less, right? They just can't be as volatile with their messaging. And one of the things that the press conference was meant to do was, a lot of times you had the problem where the Fed had a meeting, then it was just a statement. The regional presidents would give their own views, but it didn't necessarily represent what the committee was saying. So the point of having the press conference was to have the chair kind of set the tone. And once you had the chair's message, regional, you know, presidents and different governors could say what they wanted, but you knew where the center of gravity was, right? So that's kind of the point. But if the chair himself is vacillating, then that's problematic. I think that's more the problem rather than him speaking. It's him speaking in ways, and it's not that he necessarily needs to be cheerleader, but the problem was that is because he became so let's put it this way. During his confirmation hearing, mm-hmm. Chair Powell said something that really took me by surprise. He said that the positive effects of the tax cuts might last 2 to 3 years.
Right.
And I thought, wow, that's a really bullish forecast that most people on Wall Street don't even have. And so the tension has been between how strong an effect is the fiscal stimulus versus how big a drag is the trade tensions, right? And I think that dynamic has flipped a lot in the last few weeks where they see the tax cut benefits fading. And so, you know, we'll see where he lands. But yeah, he's put himself in a pickle, but not because he's speaking, but because he's not being coherent.
Right. I think that's a good point. We're taking a quick break. We're going to be back with Pedro da Costa right after this, talking a little bit more about the Fed. And Pedro, when we come back, I want to, you know, you, as you said, you've followed, you know, Alan Greenspan, Ben Bernanke, you know, Janet Yellen. And recently, Janet Yellen made an interesting comment, and it kind of goes back to, you know, messaging and what goes on here, and particularly after, you know, what we hear after Fed presidents, you know, leave office. Ben Bernanke had some different views that came out after he left office than when he was actually Fed chairman. I wanted to visit with you for that for a few minutes. We'll be back more with the Lance Roberts Show right here at realinvestmentadvice.com.
Got a question for Lance later? Ask now at realinvestmentadvice.com.
And welcome back to the Lance Roberts Show right here at realinvestmentadvice.com. Our special guest today, of course, Pedro da Costa, writes for Market News International, Forbes, Market Watch. You can find him just about everywhere. But he's a longtime follower and reporter of the Federal Reserve. And really, there's no better guy to go to get really kind of an insight on what the Fed may be thinking and doing than Pedro, because he's been right in the middle of it this whole time. We left off talking a little bit about Jerome Powell getting himself to a bit of pickle about communications. And I thought it was interesting, you know, Janet Yellen made a comment, I guess about a year or so ago, that, we wouldn't see another financial crisis in our lifetimes. And of course, just recently, there was a comment basically to the point that, well, very likely we could see another financial crisis. You know, there's been a reversal that we've seen out of Fed chairs. When Ben Bernanke left office, he had some different opinions about the economy and the markets and kind of monetary policy than some of the things he had said when he was in office. And we've seen that kind of across time. You know, what they say when they're not in the spotlight is sometimes different than when they're actually in the hot seat of the Fed chair. Is that surprising to you at all?
Not particularly. I mean, basically, when they are chair, that happens, to be honest, because I got to watch the transition of Ben Bernanke from governor to, because he was a Fed governor in 2002, and then he became chairman in 2006, I believe. And then similarly with Janet Yellen, she was San Francisco Fed president, so I used to cover her back then and we had kind of full access to her. All the wire service reporters would just sit down and ask Yellen as many questions as we wanted until, you know, it was like just four of us and Janet Yellen. And then later on, she was protected by guards and we couldn't speak with her anymore.
Right.
But then I got to watch her transition to vice chair and then to chair. And what happens is when you become chair, you get to be a little less bold about like pushing the envelope on policy because you become a herder of policymaking cats, you know, that you have to get a consensus in the middle. And so you can't really be on the edge of policy anymore. And you have to be, you become a centrist by, you know, by function.
Right.
And so once they get out of office, I think they become slightly bolder in their prescriptions. I wouldn't say that their views like necessarily changed, but they evolved in a way. So basically the main thing that Bernanke and Yellen have been arguing, and they've been arguing it pretty actively now, it's not so much to worry about the financial crisis, but the thing that strikes me, which is relevant to how the Fed is thinking about policy now, is this, is the Fed has basically come to terms with the notion that if the neutral rate, you know, that they're going to max out at is around 3%, so we're not that far away from it.
Right.
If rates are going to peak at 3%, they might not have enough room to cut rates in the future recession without getting to zero again.
Right.
And so they've converged on the notion that they need some kind of plan or framework to dealing with the zero bound that's more permanent and that markets can be accustomed to before we get there, as opposed to having the crisis and having to concoct QE, right, you know, sort of on a dime and with a lot of criticism because of that, because it wasn't kind of in the books.
Right.
So Bernanke has a slightly different proposal than Yellen's, but they're very similar. Basically, it's some kind of commitment to overshooting the inflation target if you hit the lower zero bound for a prolonged period, basically. And that's where they're headed with policy. And that's kind of, to be honest, it's actually still feeding ideas into what active policymakers are considering, because the Fed is reviewing its framework. It's not so sure that the 2% inflation target is going to be, you know, a permanent way to think about it.
Right.
Canada has a every five years it reviews the way it conducts monetary policy. And there's a lot of pressure at the Fed to kind of conduct similar rethinking of their framework. So
you know,
might be in for more talk about QE in the not so distant future.
Right. Well, you know, I think that's very interesting, too, because I was actually published a chart earlier this week, you know, looking at the Fed funds rate going back to 2008, you know, during the financial crisis itself. And, you know, I was almost kind of surprised, you know, we've gotten so long, you know, we've been so long with such low, you know, Fed funds rate. I'd forgotten that the Fed funds rate was 4.2%. back in 2008. So we went from 4.2% to zero, and the Fed balance sheet went from $900 billion to $4 trillion, you know, during the whole QE process of trying to bail the markets out of the financial crisis. The reason I bring this up is because it seems interesting to your point that, you know, even if we can get to 2.5% or 3% on the Fed funds rate, that doesn't leave you a whole lot of movement back to zero to try to, you know, fix another, you don't even have to call it a financial crisis. Let's just call it a, you know, a credit-related event of some sort that really drags on the stock market, right? So, you know, Ben Bernanke back in 2010, 2011, when he was talking about QE2, he said, you know, one of the big important things here is about creating a wealth effect, because we need this wealth effect to get people to go consume. We've got an economy 70% driven by consumption, so people need the confidence to help drive economic growth. And, you know, so if we get into a situation where you have a contraction in the market that leads to a negative wealth effect, it doesn't leave the Fed a whole lot of room, because you're still at almost a $4 trillion balance sheet. The balance sheet went up 200% from 2009 to 2017. They can't really double their balance sheet again from here, and they don't have a whole lot of downside support on rate structures. It seems the Fed may be in a much tighter position here to try to navigate the next bear market when it comes.
I think that's definitely right, and that's why they're thinking about it a little bit ahead of time. They think they have a lot of time because they're not forecasting a recession anywhere in the foreseeable future, although, as you know, the market's own estimates for recession probabilities have been shifting lately.
Right.
And there's been renewed concern in different corners of the market. I think the Fed's tools will be more limited, but not completely, because again, they have forward guidance. I think QE is still a powerful tool that they could deploy They're not completely out of room there, but they're cognizant of the fact that they're not quite, they don't have the same kind of ammunition that they did before the Great Recession.
And I guess, you know, when, if you had to pin on, you know, the Fed and say, you know, out of all the reporting and researching that you've done and talking to them, you know, is there an overriding concern that is really the one thing that they're watching very carefully? You know, they talk a lot about the inflation rate. They say employment's strong right now, so there's not a whole lot of worry. And again, as you correctly stated, you know, they're not forecasting recession anytime soon. And of course, government agencies never do. They never predict a recession. So, no, it's just, you know, 10 years for the CBO, right? We'll never have another recession.
Exactly.
But, you know, do you think in, you know, kind of behind closed doors that they may be much more cognizant of the risk of a recession?
I don't know if they're I don't know if they're worried about recession risk yet, mm-hmm. but they're worried about a slowdown, right? They went from thinking that growth maybe would surprise to the upside. Let's put it that way. They went from thinking that, oh, maybe 3% will be sustained over 2 to 3 years to thinking like, oh, actually, you know, we have a crashing oil price, we have a crashing stock market, we have worries about business investment, which they specifically flagged in their statement.
Right.
And then Powell flagged another set of concerns, which was slowing overseas growth, mm-hmm. The lagged effects of the Fed's own monetary policy, and in addition, the fading effects of the fiscal stimulus, which he apparently wasn't worried about, you know, a few months ago because he thought they were going to last 2 to 3 years. So it's that shift. I wouldn't say it's quite a shift toward recessionary expectations, but it's, you know, they went from, again, it's kind of a strange mistake to make because I could go back to stories that I've written about how repetitive this pattern is, where the Fed starts the year with forecasts for 3% growth and several rate hikes,
right,
only to end the year. You know, this year is a perfect example. I actually saw a great article on Forbes recently about all Jamie Dimon had predicted that the 10-year was going to end the year at like 4.6 or something.
Right.
You know, and all these forecasts just are ridiculous. And the Feds are included in that. So
take a quick break. We're going to come back with Pedro da Costa. We're going to wrap up our interview. Pedro, when we come back, I kind of just want to, you know, kind of spitball a few things with you, talking a little about, you know, because you've made a couple of allusions to, you know, what's happening with policy, not just at the Fed, but also kind of globally, trade tensions, what's happening there. Of course, one of the impacts that we're seeing from Fed rate hikes is the impact on the housing market. Kind of like get your input on, you know, how you think those are affecting the overall economic outlook and potentially the market outlook and the Fed's actions going forward. We'll be right back with Pedro da Costa right after the break, right here on the Lance Roberts Show podcast at realinvestmentadvice.com.
You can get daily real investment news you can use, delivered at the speed of the internet. Sign up for Lance's newsletter now at realinvestmentadvice.com.
And welcome back to the Lance Roberts Show podcast here at realinvestmentadvice.com. Our special guest today, Pedro da Costa, author, reporter, and writer. He just told me, he just broke it here. Breaking news on the Lance Roberts Show. He's writing a book. What's the name of the book, Pedro?
Mend the Fed is my working title.
I like it. So there we go. Mend the Fed. We're then budding author right here, but also great reporter, writes for Market News International, Forbes, MarketWatch, and of course has a long history of articles, and we publish his articles every week as well. So Pedro, right before the break, we were talking a little bit about, you know, this kind of outlook for the economy that the Fed's dealing with, and they're trying to balance, you know, their messaging relative to what's actually happening in the economy. And you mentioned about the effect of Fed policy. And one thing that I wrote about very early this year and actually part of last year was beware of what you wish for with rising interest rates, because, you know, we had a lot of people coming out saying, you know, interest rates are going to go, as you said, Jamie Dimon, interest rates 4%, et cetera. I said, be very careful with that because we have an entire economy built on leverage, whether it's housing or corporate debt, that was all financed and driven around ultra low rates. And interest rates at, you know, when you have a house note and your house note goes from 4% to 5%, you know, it's a 25% increase, you know, in your interest payment. And with a lot of Americans really living paycheck to paycheck and have not really experienced the wealth effect from the rise in the market, you know, it's been very contained to really about the top 10-15% of the economy. Those make an important immediate impact on people that are making monthly payments. And we're already starting to see that in the housing market, auto sales, all showing signs of softening. Do you think that that is also feeding into kind of the Fed's considerations about, you know, their quote unquote effective neutral rate on where they raise rates to?
I hope it is. I'm not sure about that. That's a question that I like the way you framed that. I'll next time I get a Fed official on the record or off the record, I'll phrase it to them that exact way. But I hope they're taking it into consideration because they tend to focus on the macro GDP, you know, number and the headline unemployment rate.
Right.
But we have a very bifurcated economy, as you pointed out, where people don't see the benefits of growth. And they definitely do see the downsides of even smaller increase in interest rates. Mm-hmm. And so I think that, yes, the Fed is starting to become cognizant, at least, of the effects of its own policies. And that applies to the overseas outlook as well, right? Because,
right.
You know, there was always the very obvious prediction that the party was going to end at some point. And as the Fed started to hike, that the emerging markets would not fare so well. And sure enough, the weaker ones have shown significant signs of strain, places like Turkey and Argentina and South Africa. But I think the main worry for everybody is really China. Because people talk about EM, everything is small potatoes. China is the big kahuna. That's the too big to fail economy. And that's one of the reasons why the market, I think, has been tanking and why, you know, even the Fed's own sentiment has changed, is that there's a sense that despite this sort of pretend kiss and make up between Trump and Xi Jinping at the G20, that it's really not over. And that, you know, and especially after the arrest of the Huawei CFO, that this is a trade where corporate leaders start to get arrested. I don't know if you saw, but today the retaliation was that a former Canadian minister who's now a businessman in China was also arrested. So this doesn't look very good. And if the two largest, and when I heard on CNBC, you know, an analyst say, like, if I were an American CEO, I'd be afraid of traveling to Beijing right now. Right. That's pretty severe, right? That's well beyond a trade war. That's like, you know, that gets into the military sphere, to be honest. So that's pretty frightening.
Well, no, you know, look, there's, you know, it doesn't take a historian very long to go back through history and look at the impacts of trade wars and how trade wars tend to wind up in shooting wars ultimately because of exactly these things, right? And just for the record, I'm not saying we're about to wind up in a shooting war with China. I'm just saying that historically speaking, when you start applying tariffs, they tend to result in other outcomes that are always the less intended consequence, right? The unintended consequence. And, you know, we're particularly seeing that now. And I thought Doug Cass summed it up really well when he said the G20 meeting was more like he said, she said. So
yeah, I love that one. That was great.
But, was, you know, good. You know, it, but the point here is, and this is a question to you. So, you know, we've had tax cuts earlier this year. The market really didn't respond to that. And now, unfortunately, we're at the end of the year. So when we begin comparing earnings growth next year, we begin to do that on a year-over-year basis. So the effect of the tax cut for corporate earnings growth is going to disappear next year. So earnings growth rates are going to fall more back towards the rate of revenue growth and, of course, you know, economic growth, which is potentially going to be running between 2 and 3%. Then we look on the other side, we've got these trade wars and trade tensions that are going on. We've already had corporation after corporation with corporate earnings coming out saying, hey, trade wars aren't working for us. The tariffs are hurting our earnings. And, you know, what's happening overseas isn't good. And then not to mention, of course, as you stated, the geopolitical stresses, not just with China, but also with a variety of other countries, you know. It seems to me that the markets are beginning to understand that the U.S. cannot remain this island of economic strength in the midst of the world that we live in today, and that we're ultimately probably going to play catch up with the rest of the world at some point, maybe sooner rather than later. I wanted to get your thoughts on that.
I think that's absolutely right. I think the international outlook, I think, and that's part of the, you know, what everybody's been saying about trade wars. And of course, the Trump administration is not going to listen because that's the kind of the core philosophy. Mm-hmm. But, you know, basically, in order to have a successful trade war, you have to get China's economy to suffer so badly that you're hurting yourself, right? Because you depend on China's economic growth. And if you watch that growth collapse, then your market's going to suffer and your growth is going to get hurt.
Right.
And so, like you said, the interconnections are so great. And now we see, you know, French growth struggling and European growth kind of, which was it had been a leading light for a year or so. Now that's kind of struggling a little bit. So it's hard to see where the future sources of growth are going to come from. And, it's more about a retrenching, environment of retrenchment now than one of expansion.
Well, it's an interesting point when you talk about France, and really goes, it's France, which I thought was interesting. When you take a look at France's economy, they're heavily indebted and economically becoming more risky, overall, particularly when you take a look at what's happening with the French revolts, et cetera, that are going on right now. And yet their solution was to cut taxes and raise wages. So, it seems that we have country after country following the same prescription of this idea of almost kind of catering to populist ideas, which is, cut taxes, raise wages, and that's somehow going to magically fix your debt problem, which is exactly the same problem we have in the U.S. Here's my big concern, Pedro, between you and me and the Fence Post and all of our listeners, which is that we're running a $1 trillion deficit in an economic expansion. That's my big worry, because that has never historically worked out well. And particularly when you look at what's happening overseas, it seems that we're replicating the same bad economic policy globally, not just domestically.
So I would disagree with you in the following way. I'm very deficit dovish when it comes to the United States.
Okay.
But the United States is a very particular case. We have the world's reserve currency. We are a currency union in the sense that all of our states use the same currency, but we're an independent sovereign state that can issue debt unlimited. We don't have an inflation problem. So I don't see the deficit as a problem in the United States. In France, the deficit becomes a problem. And now Macron is stuck between this sort of like, either he caters to the protesters and grants some spending and wage increases and then gets downgraded by the rating agencies, or vice versa, right?
Right.
Or he gets props from Wall Street, but then he gets yellow vest protests on a daily basis that he can't really live with.
Right.
But the problem with France is that they're stuck in the EU, and the EU hasn't decided to issue euro bonds yet. So if the European Union were a full fiscal union that could issue bonds, then yes, it would have the fiscal firepower to potentially use the deficit in a productive way.
Right.
So the other distinction I would make is that I wouldn't even call our move here populist, because as you noted earlier, the tax cuts were overwhelmingly focused on the rich. So
right.
it's a strange kind of elitist populism to focus on the estate tax, right? I mean,
right.
At least a real populist president would at least give some bread and circus to the people. And there's not much bread and circus to go around in the States. At least in France, they kind of, but in France, it might even be harder, because the political parties are very entrenched. If you look at the yellow vest protesters, the more I learn about them, it's kind of fascinating. There are right wing and left wing factions within that protest. So it's very complicated politics that I'm only kind of getting my head around now. But it doesn't look like Macron's future is very bright politically.
Yeah, no, there's no doubt about that. And it's interesting, too, because you're actually seeing the same thing occurring in Germany with Angela Merkel. Her political hold over Germany has been eroding over the last several years. So you're seeing the same kind of issue with a lot of the major governments around the world, is this underpinning. Take a look at what's going on with Theresa May and, of course, the whole Brexit issue.
Yes.
It's a big change.
The populist wave is definitely a global phenomenon, and I wouldn't even call it populist. I'd say it's sort of proto-fascist in some places. I'm originally from Brazil, and we do have a pretty much a fascist president-elect, and God only knows what's going to happen when he takes over in January.
Yeah.
But it might be violent, because I think there are going to be a lot of protests, and he's not going to hesitate to use military force. He's surrounding himself with generals. He has, sadly, fairly overwhelming popular support because of the level of corruption that happened in the preceding administration.
Right.
And if you think about it in terms of global growth, right, people don't think about Brazil because Trump takes so much oxygen in the news that you don't think about Brazil as much as one should. But it is the second largest economy in this in the Americas, and
right.
It could have a pretty strong ripple effect on other places.
No doubt about that. Pedro, we've been talking with Pedro da Costa today, reporter for Market News International, also Forbes and Market Watch. Anything I didn't ask you today that you think is important that you'd like to talk about?
So I did want to tell you one funny story about Fed communications and rookie mistakes, if you don't mind.
Sure.
So Bernanke's rookie mistake is probably the funniest one. Bernanke goes to the White House Correspondents' Dinner. I think he had just taken office, right? He just started becoming chair. And he attended the White House Correspondents' Dinner. And he sat at the CNBC table. And he chatted, apparently, with Maria Bartiromo and others. Mm-hmm. Sure. Now, the ground rules of the dinner is that it's off the record, right? Mm-hmm. So none of what they say to you then are you supposed to use for your reporting, you know, publicly in any way, shape, or form.
Right.
And that the following Monday, this is on a Saturday, the following Monday, Maria Bartiromo, I'm sitting at the Reuters office watching CNBC, and Maria Bartiromo is at the CBOE in Chicago interviewing then Chicago Fed President Michael Moscow. And halfway through the interview, she didn't seem to realize like what she had, or she didn't break the news. She just kind of slipped it into conversation. She said, you know, President Moscow, I was talking to Ben Bernanke this week, and he told me the market totally misinterpreted his remarks, sort of as overly hawkish or overly dovish. I can't remember the direction, but basically this, the pit behind her goes wild, okay? The pit behind her starts almost in like a movie-esque kind of manner. And here's the kicker. She and Michael Moscow didn't realize why the market was moving. So she goes, oh, I wonder what's happening. And he turns to her and he says, oh, they're probably just excited that you're here, Maria. And it was one of the best moments of CNBC I've ever watched in my entire life. And you know what happened? Bernanke never attended one of those dinners ever again because we'd invite him every year. And he became a lot more reticent about talking to reporters, unfortunately.
I will say this. So I've been in the market since 1987. And, you know, I do think that, you know, I know you really, you like the speed of information. We talked about that earlier. But I do think that maybe in a lot of cases, you know, market information moves too fast these days. Yeah. And that, you know, I do personally long for the days where, you know, it actually took a couple of days to get earnings announcement out so that we weren't, you know, scalping $300 billion in market cap off some company because they missed, you know, a penny's worth of earnings, right?
And I see your point. I see your point about, like, being able to digest information before you make investment decisions.
Exactly. Yeah, that's really just my point. You know, high-frequency trading and what's going on, I think, is going to be...
Sure. No, but that's a point. But that I would argue that's an issue about... you know, properly regulating markets so they function well rather than like offering them less information. Because right. I think information is just good for the investors, period. Unless it's sort of a cacophony. Like I said, I think Fed officials should do some level of coordinating and not like speak over one another, one hawk and one dove speaking on the same day. There should be some level of coordination, but that's not an argument against transparency. It's an argument for cohesive messaging.
Exactly, right. Well, Pedro, hey, I really appreciate your time today. It was an awful lot of fun, and I would certainly like to do this again sometime with you, and particularly as we have stuff coming out, you know, from the Fed and kind of what's happening. Particularly, I think 2019 may be a lot more challenging year than many people expect. So I'd certainly like to have you back to talk more about that, keep people up to date.
My pleasure. I really enjoyed it. Thanks so much.
Appreciate it. Pedro DaCosta, you can find him at Market News International, Forbes, and MarketWatch. And, of course, every week, on our website, realinvestmentadvice.com, for our reading list. You'll find his articles there as well. And we'll see you next time on the next edition of Lance Roberts Show right here at realinvestmentadvice.com.
Want a longer talk with Lance about your money? Request a personal one-on-one at realinvestmentadvice.com. It's a rich man's world.